Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, January 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Upstate Dermatology, now with an office in Saratoga Springs, providing medical and surgical dermatology services, including Mohs surgery with 6 locations in the Capital Region and Western Massachusetts. UpstateDerm.com. The holidays can be a rough time for people battling substance abuse. The new year can represent a chance at a fresh start, yet many not sure where to turn for help. Dr. Angad Madan, medical director for St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center, and Frank Babich, who oversees the medical program at Spark Cohoes, are here to talk about addiction and how people can get fast access to life-saving treatment. The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On today's Medical Monday, we're joined by Dr. Angad Madan, medical director for the St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. Dr. Madan strives to improve awareness of Spark's rapid access walk-in clinics for same-day treatment of opioid use disorder and is dedicated to helping further education of medication-assisted treatment among medical providers in the Capital Region. Also joining us is Frank Babich, a physician assistant specializing in addiction medicine who oversees the medical program at Spark Cohoes. Frank has been working in the addiction medicine and behavioral health fields since 1996. Got a question today about addiction and addiction recovery? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Madan and Mr. Babich, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
So what is Spark?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us on the show, Ray.
My pleasure.
Spark is the St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. It is part of the St. Peter's Hospital, and in conjunction with the St. Peter's Health Partners, we are an umbrella organization that offers all levels of care when it comes to addiction treatment, whether it's inpatient rehab, detox unit, rapid access walk-in clinics, outpatient clinics, so cover all levels of care. And we meet patients where they're at.
Yeah. What do you mean? You go to their homes?
We meet them where they're at, where in terms of we accommodate whatever level of care they want to pursue. If they're more of a candidate for rehab, then we'll help them out with that. If they want to do more outpatient, we'll help them out with that. So we kind of meet them where they're at. And
what percentage, just ballpark it for me, of people who you work with are inpatient as opposed to those who go to rehab and they're outpatient?
Percentage is kind of hard to gauge, but both levels of care have been really busy, whether it's inpatient or outpatient.
Yeah, there's much more turnover in regard to the inpatient process because detoxification is usually a hospital-based service that we provide. It tends to be short. I always say it's about 72 hours, give or take, depending upon the complexity, sometimes more, sometimes less, whatever the person requires. Rehab is usually 28 days. So the vast majority of our patients do typically end up in our outpatient clinics where people will actually come and participate sometimes for years.
Mm. You know, we see movies. We've all seen The Man with the Golden Arm or some of these movies where, you know, serious addiction to heroin or whatever. And you say it only takes 72 hours for the actual physical process of detoxification?
So
the answer. Well, it depends on which substance in particular, whether it's alcohol and benzodiazepines, the window for complicated withdrawal is 72 hours per the American Society of Addiction Medicine. To make sure you're safe, you're no longer in that window for withdrawal seizures or delirium tremens, you're safe to go home. But post-acute withdrawal syndrome is a serious thing. You know, post-acute withdrawal symptoms last 2 to 3 weeks. That's kind of where you work with counseling to address that anxiety of coming off of a substance, you know. So there is post-acute withdrawal the last weeks after the acute hospitalization phase.
I assume, and I might be wrong, that the most common addiction you guys are dealing with is alcohol?
I would say, yeah, 50% or more of presentations are alcohol withdrawal, especially in the Capital Region.
Really? And does it vary throughout the country?
It does vary. But we see everything. We see all substances, though. Having said that, we see alcohol, benzodiazepines, cocaine, heroin.
What's benzodiazepine? What is that?
Basically, that's illicit benzodiazepine, Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin, sedative hypnotics that are either obtained from the street or from a medical prescriber and are overused and misused, and patients become chemically and physiologically dependent to those. And the minute they stop taking those, they go into acute withdrawal. So we see all of those.
We're joined by Dr. Angad Madan and also Frank Babich today from SPARC, St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. Number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. All right, doctor, explain to me what exactly goes on in a physical addiction. In other words, you take a substance and you become physically addicted to it. You hear, oh, well, this is not a physically addictive substance about this, that, or the other thing. What happens to the body?
Thank you for that question. That's a great question, Ray. And a common question that many patients ask to me is, how do I get to this point? And it's really, we view addiction as a chronic medical illness that has neurological, psychiatric, internal medicine. You know, it covers all gamuts of medicine. There's the neurological, psychiatric, and internal medicine components. But really, when you're looking at the brain, addiction causes the part of the brain that wants, the part of the brain that has, you know, more cravings, that want, that kind of revs up the cravings, that part of the brain, the activity goes up. So that's the dopaminergic centers of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, the basal ganglia, the amygdala. Those craving centers are revved up during an addiction. That's kind of a very important point to make there. And then the part of the brain that kind of, you know, tells us, you know, this isn't the best thing for me to do. This is, you know, the moral or executive decision making, the prefrontal cortex of the brain. That part of the brain activity is lower. It's less active. And this has been demonstrated by PET scan studies they've done with many patients who have had, you know, various substance use addictions.
Very interesting. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We are joined by Dr. Angad Madan and also Frank Babich from St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. The, how do I put it exactly? Yeah, we'll come back to it. Number here is 800-348-2551. What is xylazine?
Xylazine is a high-potency sedative tranquilizer that was used in veterinary medicine for years to sedate large animals. It has found its way in much of the fentanyl supply, and chances are if patients are using an opioid like heroin or fentanyl, they are exposing themselves to xylazine. So it's a relatively new phenomenon that xylazine's been finding its way into fentanyl.
Where's it all coming from?
Well, a big part of it is, you know, and the DEA and law enforcement agencies are working on cracking down on these, you know, cartels at our southern border. So, you know, we have had over the past year a decrease in fentanyl-related overdoses, a heavy decrease because of law enforcement activity on the southern border on the cartels, but along with the addiction medicine treatment that we do. But xylazine that's mixed in fentanyl patients often present with wounds, superficial ulcerations all across the arms and the legs. So it's a really scary substance.
Mm.
We don't know exactly what causes these superficial skin ulcerations, but the theoretical cause that's being proposed is that it causes vasoconstriction of the arteries supplying the cutaneous skin layers.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, you get hypoxia, you know, decreased perfusion, decreased wound healing, cellulitis, and abscesses when those ulcers get infected. We do see a lot of those in our addiction programs.
One of the very frightening things with respect to xylazine is the fact that most people don't use drugs thinking, I'm going to go use xylazine. It's what we often refer to as an adulterant, where it gets added to other substances to kind of increase their effectiveness or the duration of the high that people experience. So often what we're seeing is illicitly manufactured fentanyl combined with illicitly manufactured xylazine because it it ends up giving a more potent effect. Now, the problem is that potency, because along with the lesions that Dr. Madan mentioned, we're also seeing a drastic increase in overdoses and accidental overdoses, especially when you're combining the xylazine with the synthetic opioid.
Let's talk about fentanyl for a minute. In the green room, you guys really surprised me. You said almost every street drug that you see is in some way adulterated by fentanyl. First of all, explain what fentanyl is and what the real danger is here.
Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that in many cases could be up to thousands of times the potency of morphine. It's a synthetic, semi-synthetic opioid that's like heroin, but thousands of times the potency of morphine. And one use of fentanyl could lead to fatal mortality via opioid overdose. So what was the second part of the question there, Sam?
Well, why? Well, you said it's from what you know, it's in almost every street drug,
yes.
And that includes pot and everything else.
Yes.
What's the advantage of doing that if you are a big-time drug dealer, if you're going to kill your customers?
Yep. Great question to ask, Ray. Very common question there. Fentanyl can be found in any illicit substance from the street that patients use, whether it's K2, cannabis, cocaine, methamphetamines, you name it. And it is just fentanyl is cross-contaminated or cross-cut and makes its way into these substances via when it's prepared by the drug dealers and the cartels.
So is it
it's more accidental,
as we're going to say.
I would suspect so, that they cut it with the same material, you know, whether it's intentional or not, that's hard to tell. But I think, you know, via cross-cutting, you know, when it's cut with the same material, it makes its way into there.
There's an interesting phenomena that kind of goes, it's counterintuitive, because people who are experiencing the disease of addiction, there's often a rational thought that goes with that.
So irrational or irrational?
Irrational.
Okay.
So whereas you would think exactly like I think your question just asked, why as a dealer would you put something in your drug that might kill someone?
Right.
I've spoken with patients who have relayed to me that when they're on the street, if they actually hear that somebody overdosed, the thought process isn't stay away from that. The thought process is often, that's really good stuff, which is terrifying.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
We'll take a break here, but I want to talk about what you know about the mindset of people. And you just alluded to it just now. How addiction happens. A lot of people who get addicted to drugs or alcohol or whatever are extremely smart. They're rational and they're brilliant in many ways. What happens? Let's talk about that. If you have a question for Dr. Madan or Frank Babich or both, 800-348-2551 is our number, or voxpop@wamc.org is the email. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. It's Addiction Recovery Today with Dr. Angad Madan and Frank Babich from Spark in Cohoes. And Spark, I guess St. Peter's Addiction Recovery has many locations, right?
Correct. We have two inpatient rehabs, an inpatient detox unit on the sixth floor of St. Peter's Hospital, 5 outpatient sites.
Well, you're the director. Are you deciding who gets inpatient and who goes home?
Well, that's decided by the individual providers at each site. And if the providers have any issues, they seek my help in terms of supervision. We also have our two rapid access clinics at Spark Cohoes, one of which is headed by Frank Babich here, and the sixth floor of St. Peter's Hospital, which has an ambulatory clinic.
Spark Cohoes, then, people have OD'd and you see them, or how do people get there?
So we are an outpatient clinic. We provide addiction services across the spectrum of all substances. We are primarily outpatient clinic with the addition of the ancillary program, which is the walk-in clinic. Our walk-in clinic is specifically designed for people who have opioid use disorder and are in need of rapid access to treatment. Our outpatient clinic is a combination of services provided from the medical side by myself, along with an addictions certified RN. We also are staffed with multiple CASAC, certified addiction counselors, who provide both individual and group therapy to people who are in need, as well as assistance with case management services.
And doctor, I'll throw this to you. You find that group therapy is valid and helps overall? Or, I mean, do people always want to be helped?
Well, in many cases, yes. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to be effective, along with, in the individual format, groups, meetings. It reinforces that prefrontal cortex of the brain. Remember, we talked about that part of the brain that's a moral or executive reasoning. The part of the brain where it tells you to make good decisions, you know, that part of the brain, the lights are dim. So cognitive behavioral therapy, whether in the individual or group format, along with meetings, reinforces that prefrontal cortex of the brain to counteract the cravings.
Can you get the prefrontal cortex to fire back up after addiction is fought successfully?
Absolutely, you can. That study we talked about with the PET scans, it was done with patients who were addicted to methamphetamine. But what happened was, after 12 to 16 months, the prefrontal cortex activity was restored, and the craving centers of the brain, the amygdala and the nucleus accumbens and the basal ganglia, the activity that was hyperactive was lowered back towards baseline. So 12 to 16 months of sobriety, at least a year, I would say, can restore that normalcy.
How many patients on average make it that far, 12 to 16 months?
Oh, statistics-wise, I don't have those numbers off my head, but
we've had
many that made it to at least a year of sobriety. Yes,
I think Dr. Madan said a couple of really important things too. You know, when we talk about addiction, we talk about the disease of addiction, and we do that for a reason. Just like people don't choose to have diabetes or don't choose to have asthma, addiction isn't something that people choose. You know, you can take two people, one who both use an addictive substance such as cocaine. One person can develop, you know, an overwhelming disease of addiction, and the other person can be fine.
So it really is. I mean, I've heard this for years and said, well, it's a choice. It's not a disease. It's not cancer. It's not something like that. But you're saying, yes, this is a disease.
It is. Yeah, it's a chronic disease, just like congestive heart failure, hypertension, or type 1 diabetes. And we're switching from a model where years past we viewed it as a moral failing. And now we're at a crossroads where we're trying to switch to a model of a chronic disease, just like congestive heart failure or type 1 diabetes. And one interesting statistic, the American Society of Addiction Medicine came out with research indicating that 50% of addiction is hereditary. Huge genetic hereditary component there.
How do we quantify that? How do you come to 50%?
Well, I think ASAM has more details on that, but I think studying those gene sites, I'll have to get more information there, but their literature says 50% of addictions has a hereditary component.
But still, by the same token, you don't choose to get cancer. You don't choose to get diabetes,
right? Well, it's nature versus nurture. It's the hereditary component and your environment, you know, the psychosocial environment that you're in.
Well, let's talk about why people become addicted. And Frank, you talked about the fact that two people can use cocaine often and one could become a terrible addict and one might not have that problem. What is it physiologically and also mentally, emotionally, that makes people cross that line? Do you guys have any idea?
I wish I knew that answer.
I think there's a lot of dual diagnosis component. One of St. Peter's affiliated organizations, the MICA unit, that's the mental health dual diagnosis units. Dual diagnosis units are opening across the country, addressing both mental health and addiction. And there's a heavy correlation that they're seeing between someone who's has a predisposition developing bipolar disorder, depression, or PTSD is more likely to develop a substance use disorder. So that dual diagnosis component is something that we're learning more about and trying to more aggressively treat with dual diagnosis.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Angad Madan and Frank Babich from St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center join us. This email from Mandy. Do you have any suggestions on where to turn for help with alcohol addiction in Alzheimer's patients? Alzheimer's groups haven't had many ideas, and that's from Mandy.
Great question.
I think with respect to alcoholism in general, and specifically as the question asks in regard to Alzheimer's, you know, alcoholism and alcohol use disorder, as we refer to it medically, is an often understated, kind of underreported syndrome. We speak about not just use disorders, but also problematic drinking, which is someone who really doesn't meet our diagnostic criteria for a severe use disorder, but their alcohol consumption puts them at a much higher risk of many different medical and mental health conditions. So you know, there are diagnostic criteria for binge drinking, for problematic alcohol consumption, as well as for a full-blown alcohol use disorder. But we definitely know that it worsens multiple mental health and medical conditions and has been linked as a causative agent for multiple conditions. So when you're looking for treatment for alcohol use disorder, I know if you're in the Capital District area, definitely consider SPARC. You know, this is what we do. It gets more complicated with the addition of other psychiatric and medical diagnoses such as dementia and various, you know, cognitive disorders. It definitely requires more of a specialized approach and often a collaborative team approach between neurology and addiction medicine, psychiatry, as Dr. Madan had mentioned. I would always start with your primary care provider, anyone who considers having problematic alcohol consumption.
You know, where do insurance companies stand on all this? Every insurance company's fully on board with subsidizing this treatment?
Yeah, I think with the American Affordable Care Act, I think that was under Obamacare, they do, the insurance policies, many do have an addiction medicine behavioral component. That was the Affordable Care Act with Obamacare. Yeah, so insurances are covering, subsidizing addiction treatment as part of mental health.
What is MAT, and when is it called for in what you do?
MAT is medication-assisted pharmacotherapy, also known as MAUD, medications for opioid use disorder. This is really, you know, a very important service we offer at both of our rapid access clinics. Rapid access clinics are, you know, the ones that we talked about on the sixth floor of St. Pete's and at Sparkahose. They take walk-in patients every single day, Monday to Friday, no appointments required. So MAT includes buprenorphine for opioid use disorder.
And what does that do?
Buprenorphine is a partial mu opioid agonist. It binds to the opioid receptor of the brain, turns it up a little bit less than halfway to prevent cravings and withdrawals and relapses to opioid use. Heroin or fentanyl or oxycodone binds to that same receptor, that mu opioid receptor, turns it up 100%. That's what makes you high and euphoric. So the buprenorphine helps prevent cravings and withdrawals and makes you feel normal but not high and euphoric because it's a partial agonist.
Can your patients then become addicted to that?
Well, patients, there are ways to taper off that medication, but kind of like we talked about earlier with the brain changes, you know, like when you have an injury to the brain, when you have an addiction that's affected that brain chemistry, well, you kind of need an aid, you know, to promote 12 to 16 months of sobriety that we talked about. So it's kind of like you fractured your ankle and you need a crutch. Well, you know, you do need an aid there. So the goal is, the biggest concern of the day is to prevent relapse with fentanyl. That's the biggest issue of the day, how to prevent those overdoses and promote lengthy sobriety to restore brain normalcy in the brain activity.
The other thing to consider as well is that, you know, you ask, can you become addicted to buprenorphine or Suboxone? In medicine, in regard to addiction is very specific in regard to the unhealthy behaviors that kind of go around the uncontrolled use of a substance. And it's often uncontrolled, as opposed to a medication, which is what Suboxone and medications for opioid use disorder are. These are prescription medications that people take in a controlled fashion that actually alleviates the need to engage in unhealthy and damaging behaviors. So you can become physically dependent on Suboxone, where if you don't take it, you would eventually, after a few days, go into withdrawal. But I don't often refer to it as addiction.
And could I add something to
sure,
that really
doctor.
Quick? We also, at both of our rapid access clinics, offer long-acting injectable buprenorphine, also known as Sublocade and Brixadi. And if you get 6 consecutive Sublocade injections once a month, so that's a period of 6 months, well, medication tapers off on its own. No withdrawals, no cravings. It's a longer-acting depot injectable formulation. It's given subcutaneously. And after 6 shots or 6 months, the medication tapers off on its own without any withdrawals or cravings. That's what we offer at the Rapid Access programs.
It's Addiction at Addiction Recovery today with Angad Madan and Frank Babich. 800-348-2551 is our number, and voxpop at wamc.org is our email address. We'll go to the phones in a moment here. This email from Sherry. Just a comment, says Sherry. People who have survived trauma often use substances to help make the pain go away. Mental pain, emotional pain, physical pain. It's coping mechanism, though not a healthy one. When trauma is present, people may not have the self-esteem necessary to take their healing seriously enough to reach out. I speak from life experience. And that's from Sherry. Comments?
I think that especially when you look at post-traumatic stress disorder, be it from life stressors, from history of abuse, from military service, across the board, post-traumatic stress disorder carries an increased risk of addiction and substance use disorder. There are evidence-based programs that have been specifically designed to address both addiction and trauma. And what we find is that concurrent treatment of both disorders is actually fairly effective. There are also some very good evidence-based therapies specifically designed to address trauma issues in particular that have been developed with market-proven efficacy. I definitely recommend, and I hear what she's saying about, you know, the reluctance to reach out for help, but there are definite means to help people.
I great point, Frank. I'd like to add to that. During my addiction medicine fellowship, one of my attendings always told me is, you know, when you have a comorbid PTSD and an addiction, a substance use disorder, you kind of want to focus on the addiction part first, the chemical dependency, targeting that, promoting some sobriety, and then delve in depth into trauma counseling. The reason being that, you know, if you delve into trauma counseling way too early, you're going to put yourself at higher risk of relapse due to the triggers of the PTSD events or the recollections of past traumatic events. So that's kind of what, you know, and many dual diagnosis programs also recommend that.
Number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Angad Madan and Frank Babich, both from St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. And let's go to the phones. We'll go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
What types of drugs does Narcan not work on, and why did Promazine lose favor to Xylazine? Promazine had a much smoother recovery.
All right, you guys get any of that?
We got some of it.
Yeah, I don't know. So Narcan is a medication that we use to treat emergent opioid overdoses for people who are at risk of significant harm or death due to overuse of opioid, typically unconscious, non-responsive, often not breathing. Narcan's a medication that can be given to people in multiple different ways. The way that's often dispensed preventatively, we give people nasal inhalers that you can use on someone that you suspect is at risk of imminent harm. Simple nasal inhaler spray goes up the nose, gets absorbed across the mucous membrane. Medication actually crosses into the brain and simply blocks those opioid receptors. So what medications does it work on? It works on opioids. It will not work on non-opioids. So for people who have overdosed on benzodiazepine, people who have alcohol poisoning, if people have used opioid combined with other substances, you can sometimes get less effect. But it should still be used if suspected opiate overdose.
Absolutely. Always use Narcan, you know, if you suspect substance use and see someone down and out. Because like we were talking about earlier, every single substance nowadays has a high likelihood of fentanyl
even
mixed
pot.
In there.
Yes. Even absolutely. Street pot.
We've had people overdose in the Capital Region, unfortunately, fatally, smoking marijuana.
So when someone overdoses on an opioid, And Narcan is used to revive them, for lack of a better term. First of all, what happens in the overdose? And then what does Narcan do to make it better, miraculously?
Yeah. So during the overdose event, those opioids from the fentanyl or heroin bind to the mu opioid centers of the brain, causing, you know, bradycardia, hypotension, respiratory depression, decreased drive to breathe. And what Narcan does is it comes in, kicks all the opioids off of that mu opioid receptor, thereby restoring respiratory activity. You may have to give multiple doses of Narcan, given the high potency of the fentanyl out there, sometimes two to three. And at St. Peter's, we've had patients on IV Narcan drips. So, you know, don't be afraid to give multiple doses of Narcan.
This is an amazing invention, though. I mean, when did Narcan hit the scene?
Narcan's been around for a very long time. What's fairly new and what we've seen kick into high gear, especially in New York State, after the drastic increase in overdoses with fentanyl, is an extremely proactive effort to get Narcan into the community's hands. New York State has passed some great legislation that allows for prescribers to prescribe this medication to people with the understanding that it's going to be used on a third anonymous person, utilizing the Good Samaritan law.
Yeah.
So with appropriate education, we can get Narcan into everyone's hands. The police carry it, EMTs carry it. And the wonderful thing is we've actually seen a dip in opiate overdose deaths in the past year or so.
Yeah. Now, if you are not, all right, you see somebody on the street out cold, you assume opioid overdose, and you administer Narcan, and it's not an opioid overdose, nothing bad happens?
No.
I mean, theoretically, anybody could be allergic to anything, but the only time you're going to be using this medication is when you suspect the person's at risk of death anyway. But otherwise, no, Narcan is actually
benefits outweigh
really good. There's very little in the way of medication interactions. So,
and whenever patients come to pick up their Narcan kits, we also offer them fentanyl and xylazine test strips. So they can test the substance they're using with these test strips to see that it has fentanyl and xylazine in it. That prompts or is another trigger that will say, hey, I need to go in and get treatment.
So how does the test strip work?
Well, you take the test strip, you know, you mix the substance in with some water, and then you just dip it in there, and it'll tell you if it has fentanyl and xylazine in it.
Is there danger in doing that? You know, every now and then you hear a story, and I don't know if they're apocryphal or not, in the news where it says, you know, police officers were conducting a raid. Several of them got ill because they were just near fentanyl.
So, yeah, fentanyl is a huge problem.
But I mean, if you're mixing
there.
It with a strip and you're hanging around with the stuff, isn't it dangerous anyway?
A big part of addiction medicine nowadays is what we refer to as harm reduction, which is we want to make sure our patients are the healthiest they can be. And I always equate this to, you know, if you have diabetes, I'm not just going to give you insulin. I'm going to teach you about healthy living and exercise and eating right. Just like with addiction, we don't just say, just don't use. It's an unrealistic expectation. Statistics over the years have shown us the expectation that someone's simply going to be abstinent and not use a substance.
Yeah.
It's an unrealistic expectation. So as a healthcare provider, our goal is to optimize health. So usually what we say is, you know, if you buy something, dump out what you have and that little residual that you have left in the original bag, put a little water in there and test it.
Okay, if people are going to buy street drugs and use them, are they realistically going to use test strips?
Yes.
Yep. Really?
Yeah.
You've seen it happen?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Our patients want to live.
Yep.
They understand the severity of the danger that's out there on the street.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get back to the phones in a minute. We're joined by Frank Babich and Dr. Angad Madan from the St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. Back in a flash. You know, I think addiction recovery, I think Dutch prog rock. There's focus here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. We're joined by Frank Babich and Dr. Angad Madan of St. Peter's Addiction Recovery. And I'll tell you what, we'll go to the phones and then we'll go back to the emails. 800-348-2551. You know, it occurs to me I may have given the fund drive number a couple times this morning. And I hope, did I do that, Zach? Did I give the fund drive number? No, earlier. Okay, don't worry about it. You know, because we're in the lockbox portion of our fund drive, which means we're raising as much money as we can before the on-air drive starts in February. And, you know, if you get on, you mention the number, and then you do a call-in show, it doesn't always work out. Barbara in Argyle. Barbara, you're on.
Hi. I would just like you to address some comments about Kratom and its abuse. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Thanks a lot. What's Kratom?
Take that question. Kratom is a very weak mu opioid agonist from Southeast Asia, but highly, highly addictive. You can overdose from Kratom. Certain, you know, not the most reputable entities have been selling Kratom as a way to get off of opioids and address opioid withdrawal, but it activates the addictive centers of the brain, binds to that same mu opioid receptor. And it's a weak agonist, and you can overdose. It does not have a ceiling for respiratory depression. There have been numerous cases of Kratom overdose, especially in the Southeast and Florida. So a highly addictive opioid that needs opioid use disorder treatment.
Is this is illegal, though, right?
No.
It's not illegal.
So it's actually an herbal. Yeah. So it's kind of sold under that you know, umbrella of a nutraceutical. You can often see, you know, gas stations and whatnot selling it. It as Dr. Madan said, it's fairly weak and it has some opioid effect to it. The problem is that it does have the potential for people with, you know, addiction potential and use disorder to become extremely problematic. And we actually treat multiple patients. I have a few patients who came solely for Kratom use.
Given the level of regulation and rules in New York State, does it surprise you that this is available in gas stations?
Yes, absolutely shocking. I can't tell you how many times I pass by a gas station.
So why?
Buy your Kratom here.
Why is it then?
That is a matter for, I think, the FDA, the regulatory bodies to really crack down on it. And it could lead to heroin use or fentanyl use. We've had patients that took Kratom and that progressed to heroin use or fentanyl use or illicit oxycodone use, which is also fentanyl.
How do you take this?
It's often pills or brewed into teas or beverages. The biggest problem, too, is that, you know, much like so many things in the realm of Kratom, this is unregulated stuff.
Yeah,
you know.
So you don't know what you're getting per se.
Yeah, you're buying some capsules of stuff at a gas station. Don't do that.
I feel like Kratom gets a pass because it's a herbal thing from Southeast Asia, and people say, "Oh, that can't harm me." Well,
yeah, like the poppies, that'll work out too.
It's a high rate of opioid overdose. Yep.
Speaking of regulation, doctor, you know, New York has legalized cannabis. How do you feel about that?
We were just talking about this earlier. Great question there. You know, the decriminalization of cannabis, that's a term I like to use, has its positives and negatives. Positives are there are dispensaries that you can get cannabis that does not contain fentanyl in it. And if patients are going to say, I'm going to use cannabis no matter what, well, we do oftentimes recommend that if you are going to obtain cannabis, please go to a dispensary. Don't buy from the street, because if you buy from the street, it's going to have fentanyl and could cause overdose. So that harm reduction aspect of things, the benefits versus the risk, is what we harp on. So it does have its positives and negatives. The negatives being encouraging
sitting on the couch eating Cheetos.
Yeah, promoting cannabis use in some ways by the advertising and the rise of these dispensaries. So
Frank, you want to add anything to that?
No, I agree with Dr. Madan. I think there are, you know, the concept that something's legal, so it's okay. Cigarettes are legal. Alcohol is legal. These are still, from a medical perspective, potentially harmful substances to people. So
Oreos are legal. I mean, yeah, if you eat enough of those, you're going to go into a coma.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
You know, when I was a kid in the 70s, it was said, pot, gateway drug. Has that changed now that it has been legalized? No. In other words, you know, the theory was, oh, you're going to go to the dealer on the corner and get your reefers, but he's also got everything else under the sun. So is it still a gateway drug?
I believe it is still a gateway drug because we talked about the model of the brain there. It does activate those craving centers of the brain, revs up those cravings, and leads to patients seeking other substances to satisfy those cravings. So the way it affects the neurological kind of chemistry there is similar to other substances. So, yeah, it does lead to other substances.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Addiction and Recovery Today with Frank Babbage and Dr. Angad Madan. And let's see. We'll. All right. So don't know what this one means. I thought I saw, this is from John in Liberty. I have no idea. Maybe you guys know what this is. I thought I saw a study many years ago where dabbing the extracts, THC extracts, was being used successfully to treat opioid addiction. Any thoughts on that? What's dabbing THC extracts mean?
So there in New York for a while, and there was a study that was done that suggested that marijuana could be used to assist with the treatment of opioid use disorder. I'm going to definitely defer to Dr. Madan to check me on this, but I'm pretty sure there was a very large study that was done, a well-done study, that showed that that wasn't very accurate.
I can't comment on that particular study, but I would say that that would not be a treatment for opiate addiction. I don't see any literature from the American Society of Addiction Medicine or any academic body that would endorse or support that.
So Nate writes in, first, I need to thank you guys very much, and overdosing is very important. I lost two friends to it and always carry Narcan on me just in case my therapist building gives it out for free. That's from Nate. Number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Dan in North Adams. Dan, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Thank you.
Yeah. So just one quick comment. Just wanted to follow up. It sounded like a quote-unquote marijuana overdose in the capital region was referenced earlier. I just wanted to see if that was anecdotal or, a firsthand information. It seems like most of those marijuana – I've never heard of a documented marijuana overdose in my life. I also – just full disclosure, I hold a cannabis license out in Salem, Massachusetts – member of the social equity program in the state of Massachusetts, also in active recovery, do see cannabis as harm reduction. But I guess my real question is on the fentanyl laced marijuana overdose, whether that was a firsthand or secondhand account.
Okay, that's a good
question. Thank you, and I'll hang up and I'll let you answer.
You sure you don't want to hang around, Dan? You want to follow up? No, he's gone. All right, so go ahead.
Yeah, Dan, thanks for that statement. That was a secondhand account of an overdose. It was technically, and I want to be real clear, it was not a marijuana overdose. No one died from a marijuana overdose. It was marijuana that had been tainted with fentanyl. And it was smoked by an opioid-naive person. So in other words, someone who had no tolerance and was not aware that there was fentanyl in it.
Thank you for that question. Yeah, I as medical director, I do work on the consultation liaison service for St. Peter's Hospital, and I have seen cases in the ICU of patients using cannabis or what they thought was cannabis from the street and accidentally overdosing on fentanyl, requiring Narcan drips.
So this is tainted stuff. This
tainted,
is
right. contaminated right. with fentanyl. Okay. Not from a dispenser, usually illicitly from the street.
Okay.
Which is why also I appreciate what Dan said, because not only is he in recovery and he has a medical card, but harm reduction, again, is a key component of addiction recovery. That's why I'm actually very happy that they decriminalized marijuana and that there are dispensaries where people who choose to use marijuana can get it safely.
Agreed.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Frank Babbage and Dr. Angad Madan join us today from St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. And let's go to Brimfield, Massachusetts. Carol, you're on.
Yes, hi. I just had one question. Klonopin, if someone's been on that drug for 35 years, nonstop, is there any chance of them getting off of it?
That's a good question, Carol. Speaking in the theoretical realm, yeah, of course. You know, it depends upon how much they're on and And they definitely should speak with a medical provider to come up with a safe protocol to attempt to get off the medication. And if it's something they're motivated to do, I absolutely have seen people successfully do it. But I've also seen people unsuccessfully do it. I think that, you know, if it's something that is seen as a goal to accomplish, I would definitely, you know, encourage you to speak to your medical provider and or for them to speak to a medical provider and come up with a plan to do so.
Okay. And they have. But this person also is showing signs of dementia now. And we're just, and I know you can't answer this question,
right,
but we're just looking at like, oh, is a clonopin, you know, I've read up on it and it's like a benzo and it can do like a whole lot of damage. So I'm just wondering if we're up against this wall that we shouldn't be fighting against. We should just spend 35 years and the person doesn't want to get off it. And that's the biggest objective here. And she's not going to do it. So I think, do we quit? I just wanted to know from you, have you been successful getting people off of clonopin that have been on it for that amount of time?
Yes, I'm going to add to that. We absolutely have. If the patient feels that the clonopin use is problematic and they want to come off of it, like Frank was saying, first talk to your primary care provider. You would want to do a very gradual and slow taper over months and months.
What
and
is
months.
Clonopin?
Clonopin is a long-acting benzodiazepine, also known as clonazepam, has a half-life of about 46 hours. So very long-acting benzodiazepine that's prescribed for anxiety disorder. But it is potentially addictive and, you know, like I was saying earlier, patients find that it's problematic and they would like to come off of it. I would reach out to your primary care physician and discuss a plan of gradually and slowly tapering over a period of at least months, if not more.
Carol, thanks a lot for the call. You said half-life. Now, I'm familiar with that term with regard to nuclear isotopes, but what exactly are we talking about here in your field?
Half-life is kind of like, you know, pharmacokinetics. You know, it's kind of like the how long a medication acts in your system. So half-life of like 46 hours means it takes like five of those half-lives for your that chemical or medication to leave your body. So the longer the half-life, the longer it acts. So shorter acting substances last a few hours, you know, and longer acting substances last all day. So
did not know that. Let's go to North Bennington. And Stephanie, you're on.
Hello. Quick question. I was recently in the emergency room for an incisional hernia, and they gave me fentanyl. And I was a little bit surprised, so I'm just wondering if you have an opinion about why they would do that and if that's okay.
Just to clarify, Stephanie, I think, they gave you fentanyl in the emergency department or to take home?
In the emergency department, yeah.
Yeah,
pain.
No. So a lot of what we're speaking of in regard to synthetic opioids on the street are illicitly manufactured, and there are different forms of fentanyl. So these are, you know, medications that are being made in street labs. Fentanyl is an appropriate medication. It's an opioid analgesic, and it definitely has its appropriate uses and purposes. So, no, I wouldn't be worried about receiving fentanyl from a medical provider in the appropriate setting.
Absolutely. 100% agreed. It has uses in the critical care and emergency room setting.
Okay.
Severe pain.
Stephanie, thanks a lot. This email from, I don't know, it doesn't say, does the body always build up a tolerance to drugs, making the user eventually want more?
Yes. This substances or chemical dependency is tolerance building. You know, tolerance is basically, by definition, you need more and more of that substance to reach that state of euphoria that you once had. So, you know, the more tolerance you have, you know, the more likely you are to go into withdrawal and, you know, require, you know, acute management of that.
We only have about a minute or two here left, so let's find out a little more about Spark and your locations and how people can find out more about the program, get in there if they need to. Either one of you is fine.
I'm sorry, what was it? What's the question?
Wow, I get that a lot. I glazed over when you were speaking. We only have about a minute.
Okay.
So let's talk about the Spark program, and let's talk about how people can find out more and how people can get in there if they need to get in there.
First place, go to our rapid access clinics, sixth floor of St. Peter's Hospital or Sparkahoe's. The walk-in hours for the sixth floor of St. Pete's is 9 to 2, and Sparkahoe's is 8:30 to 11:30. That's the best way to reach us with no appointment needed, no appointment required. Plus, you can call, I think the number for Spark is on the website. They got 24/7 confidential hotline. You can reach out and they'll connect you to the level of care that you need.
Yeah, we have a centralized intake unit at our rehab that can assist people with assessments and with recommendations for level of care. Any of the St. Peter's Health Partners emergency rooms are also available. I would hate for people to delay care. If you need help now, absolutely go to the emergency department, go to any of the St. Peter's Health Partners emergency departments. There are other agencies as well. Project SafePoint is a very good agency to reach out to.
Really quick, the ER can do day one dosing. So if you get if you're an opiate withdrawal and you get buprenorphine, the ER can dose you and then refer you to our rapid access clinics in the morning.
So. And we only have 15 seconds left here. Is there a time of year? We mentioned the holidays. Is there a time of year when, for lack of a better term, customers increase for you guys?
It varies. We always say, you know, it tends to fall off during the summer and during holidays and then pick up afterwards. It waxes and wanes, and over the years I've kind of seen it vary in flux. So I don't think there's any hard and fast rule.
Well, I got to say, fellas, this was very interesting. I learned a lot today. Dr. Angad Madan and Frank Babich of St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center. Guys, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Support comes from Berkshire Plastic Surgeons in Great Barrington and Pittsfield, offering skin cancer screenings, Botox injections, fillers, cosmetic, and reconstructive surgery. Berkshire Plastic Surgeons. Thanks again to Dr. Angad Madan and Frank Babich of St. Peter's Addiction Recovery Center for being here. Thank you for listening. Interesting calls, interesting emails. Appreciate them, I do. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Lightning Eddie Rosen screened the calls. And thanks, Ed. No Vox Pop tomorrow. We'll bring you live coverage of the official remembrance of President Jimmy Carter. And Wednesday, however, we'll talk history with my favorite historian in the whole world, Rensselaer County historian Kathy Sheehan will be with us. Stand by now for more infotainment.